Today at Reader's Corner, Charlotte McConachy, author of the new novel Once There Were Wolves. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, Charlotte McConachy talks with us about her thrilling new novel, Once There Were Wolves. The book follows wolf biologist Inti Flynn, who leads a team of fellow researchers to Scotland with the tall task of reintroducing 14 gray wolves into the remote highlands. But distrustful locals, a mysterious death, and the troubles of her own twin sister threaten to destroy everything Inti's worked for. Charlotte McConachy is a novelist and screenwriter from Australia. Her best-selling debut novel, Migrations, was translated into more than 20 languages and adapted for the screen. Once There Were Wolves is her second novel. Charlotte McConachy, all the way from Australia, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. It's so lovely to talk with you.
Well, you know, Charlotte, we've been to Moscow, we've been to London, Shanghai. We've not been to Sydney, so this is really a path breaker for us today. And I don't care how many times I do this, still amazing today that you and I are talking across so many thousands of miles it's really great. Well, your book was great as well, and I just really the minute I finished it knew that we just had to have you talk on our show talking about it. I have to ask you, was this a COVID book? I mean, was this written in the midst of COVID? And when it was finished, did you have a chance to travel and tell your story? Or did the publishers not have a U.S. book tour?
So I wrote the novel just before COVID hit. I was actually able to squeeze in a research trip to Scotland just before all the borders closed and we got trapped in Sydney. So I was kind of editing it through COVID, but I had written it before. Which meant that then I couldn't go anywhere to kind of talk about it. So it's just been lots of Zooms and lots of lovely podcast interviews.
Well, again, like I said, I so much enjoyed it, and I would love to have a visit in Boise someday when you could talk about a book like this. By the way, we have over in Sun Valley, we have the Sun Valley Writers Conference, and one of these days, I sure hope you can make it over there. You have to be there, of course, upon invitation of the conference, but they do just a fantastic job of bringing people in from all over the place, and you would fit right in with a book like Once There Were Wolves and Migrations as well. I mentioned that this was adapted for the screen. So what screen was that? And can we watch something about that?
Not yet. It's currently being adapted.
I
so,
see. Okay.
We've optioned the film rights, and there's a production company in England who are working on getting it funded at the moment. So it's still a fair way away from being on our screen as a film, but fingers crossed they can do it. It would be kind of an amazing, epic movie.
Yeah, it sure would. Well, no, again, I don't ask me why, but I missed Migrations and only caught Once There Were Wolves. But when I read about Migrations, I went right out and grabbed it. I'm holding it now in my left hand. I've already started it. So now that I've finished Once There Were Wolves, I can get into Migrations. And of course, I'll also have the opportunity down the road to see it on the screen. Now, you find your protagonists, plural, in both novels going to some very interesting places, Antarctica and then Scotland. How does a writer in Australia wind up with such insight and expert knowledge of the landscape as you have managed to convey? Were you able to travel to these places? I mean, Scotland's not such a big deal, but Antarctica?
Yes, I definitely have spent time in Scotland and Ireland, which is quite a big setting in Migrations. But no, I have never been to Antarctica. It is the top of my bucket list. But it's kind of insanely difficult to get there and very expensive. So I think it'll be something I have to work up to. Basically, I mean, I do a lot of research into if there's any place that I haven't been that I want to set something in my story, I, of course, will do kind of extensive research about it to try and get a sense of how it might feel, smell, sound. And I was very lucky. I've actually got quite a good friend who has been to Antarctica on a science mission. So I was able to kind of talk to her at length and look at her beautiful footage and just really kind of try to imagine myself into this kind of glorious place. A lot of it's wish fulfillment for me. I think I write about places I want to go to.
Well, there's no question I learned a lot about wolves from this novel, Once There Were Wolves, and it's clear that you've done significant research. The New York Times Book Review called your first novel, Migrations, a first-rate work of climate fiction, and I think it's fair to say that Once There Were Wolves could also be called climate fiction. I wonder if you could comment on your interest as an author to what is referred to as climate fiction. More specifically, maybe you could share with us what Inti means at one point in the book when she explains why wolf predators are the place to start with conservation. She says saving the planet, even saving the forest. And she talks about the role of the apex predator. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I've been kind of fascinated with this topic for a while now. I wasn't always, but migration's kind of opened my eyes up to, I guess, what's happening to our planet and the kind of crisis we find ourselves in. And that story was a speculative piece that looked at the very near future and what it will feel like to live on this planet without animals, you know, as to be the only kind of living creatures here and how terribly lonely that would be. So, I mean, that easily does fall into that category of climate fiction. Once There Were Wolves is a little bit different because it's not future set, it's kind of present day, but it certainly still looks at the impact of climate change on our environments and what we might do to slow that climate change. And one of the things I was really kind of fascinated with when I was looking into wolves was essentially to learn about their incredible power over their environments. And if we're talking about rewilding landscapes, which means, you know, turning our landscapes back to the way that they were before we had a negative impact on them, then reintroducing wolves to forests is one of the simplest and most sort of perfect ways to rewild a space. And that's because wolves, as an apex predator, have a trickle-down effect on every other animal and plant and even the water tables in their environment. And it's because they, by hunting the herbivores, so the deer, the overpopulated deer, they get the deer moving and they allow for all the tree shoots and the plants to grow again. And that has an impact on all the other animals. So lots of smaller creatures return to the environment, birds come back. They just have this amazing kind of holistic effect on their environment, which is why we say that wolves have the power to grow forests and change the course of rivers. And I kind of knew that was just, I mean, it's so kind of beautiful and fascinating, and I instantly wanted to write a novel about it.
And, of course, in your novel, the wolves are reintroduced for the express purpose of getting rid of so many deer that's just eating the landscape, so to speak, and taking, I guess, grass away from sheep. Isn't that the point?
Well, I mean, they're designed, basically the wolves will kind of move the deer along so that the forests can grow wilder and spread and you get a more healthy biodiverse ecosystem. But, you know, if we were going to kind of reclaim land from farms, we would have to, I mean, yeah, that's that's kind of a complex issue. We would probably need to reclaim that land and move the kind of the livestock off it in order for it to regrow. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a kind of a grappling force that's going on with that debate at the moment.
So we're here in Boise, Idaho, which is not that far from Yellowstone National Park, which you mention in your acknowledgments. I wonder if you could tell us how Yellowstone lays the groundwork for the idea for your novel.
Yeah, well, it was such a huge inspiration for me. There was the first kind of reintroduction of wolves project that happened back in the 90s in Yellowstone. And what's kind of wonderful about that project is that many of the scientists who worked on it have written these in-depth, amazing first-person accounts of their work. And so I was able to read a whole lot of those and get a sense of what it's actually like to work with wolves and what it means politically, socially, culturally, to do this kind of work, how difficult it is. And what kind of stuck out for me from reading about these stories was the amazing uniqueness of the personalities of the wolves. I just was stunned at how almost human they seemed and how they had these amazing adventures and kind of stories of courage and loyalty and sacrifice. And I knew that I sort of needed to take inspiration from that and kind of make the wolves in my story come to life in such a sort of unique way.
So tell us about the Caledonian Forest of Scotland into which these wolves are reintroduced.
Yeah, so this is an ancient forest that has been around since the time of the Ice Age. The funny thing about Scotland is when we think about it, about the landscape there, we have, you know, a sense of beautiful kind of bleak rolling hills covered in sheep and it's gorgeous, but it's not actually how the landscape used to be. It's not how it is meant to be. It was once covered in forest, really wild, beautiful forest. But what happened was, I think it was sort of the Victorian era when people decided to hunt the wolves, and they did things like burn the forest in order to smoke out the wolves, in order to kind of not allow the wolves anywhere to hide. And of course, there was a lot of land clearing for, you know, logging purposes. But essentially, they've gotten rid of a huge amount of their natural wild forest. And by eradicating the wolves, there was no predator to regrow this forest. And so there is a debate raging there at the moment about whether or not they should bring the wolves back. But it's also a very densely populated farming country. So, you know, where do you put the wolves, and would they just kind of go nuts on the sheep?
Yeah, well, we have some experience with that in Idaho, because when they reintroduced the wolves to Yellowstone, at least four of them were released in what is known as the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness in central Idaho. Mm-hmm. And those wolves were delisted in 2011, and I think there's around 1,500 of them today in Idaho. And a state law was passed last year that allowed the killing of 90% of them.
Yeah, that's really, I read about that. It's really upsetting to me.
Yeah, it's quite controversial. And even in places like Sun Valley, which I mentioned before, the wolves are not far away. and even people who might normally think it was a very good idea to reintroduce them, when all of a sudden their dog or cat goes missing, they have another way of looking at life. And I can certainly understand that. And we won't get into that, because we're here to talk about once there were wolves. And I want to remind our listeners that they are listening to Charlotte McConaughey, the author of Once There Were Wolves. Why don't you set this novel up for us, Charlotte? Tell us what's going on here. I did very briefly, but maybe you can fill out a little bit more than I did in the intro. Without
sure.
giving anything away, we don't give away any endings here. There's too good of an ending on this one that was totally unpredictable, but go right ahead.
I would never give a spoiler. I just try hard to set them up so that they'll be satisfying. So as you mentioned, it's a book about Inti Flynn, who's a wolf biologist, and she's bringing these wolves back to Scotland to rewild the landscape. She's got with her sister Aggie, her twin sister, who has been... She's been damaged and traumatized by something in their past that they're both kind of fleeing from. And Inti, I think, hopes that this sort of return to the wildness of their childhood will heal Aggie and bring her back to life. And meanwhile, she's furious. She's someone who's grown up hugely empathetic. She has a really rare and unique condition called mirror touch synesthesia, which means that she feels the sensations she witnesses other people experiencing. So if I had it and I saw you get punched in the face, I would feel that punch in my face. So it's this kind of really extreme version of empathy that connects her to other people, but it also makes her quite vulnerable in a way to harm. And so she's spent her childhood believing the best in people, really kind of embracing that empathetic side of herself. But now as an adult, we meet her in quite a different stage of her life. She's been changed by something. She's witnessed too much harm done to people and to nature, to wildlife. And she's pretty much had enough of people. She's angry. She can't forgive cruelty any longer. And so she's decided that she's kind of going to separate herself from other people. She's not interested in making friends or pleasing anyone. She's just there to do her work. Of course, that doesn't go to plan. And she meets a lot of people that she's going to have kind of intimate connections with, lots of conflict. She meets Duncan, the town police chief. He is her romantic interest. And then everything kind of shifts when she stumbles across the body of a mauled farmer, and she knows that her wolves are going to be blamed for this death. And so she makes a very reckless decision to protect her wolves and kind of embroils herself in this murder mystery, which becomes even more complicated when it seems as though Duncan, her new love interest, might be the prime suspect. So it's the story of her trying to solve this murder mystery, to reintroduce her wolves and protect them from harm. It's her personal relationship. It's a family drama. It's a sister story. It's ultimately, I think, the story of what it means to rewild not just landscapes but our own hearts as well.
Well, two things. First of all, I had never heard of mirror touch synesthesia. That was a new one for me. I had to look that up. And I tell you, you get the award for having the best first line of a novel, making sure that nobody's going to stop there. Because I pick up this novel and I'm reading. This is the first line of the novel, as you know. When we were eight, Dad cut me open from throat to stomach. And I thought, what is going on here? I thought this was going to be about wolves, and somebody just got to the protagonist. And I thought that was just such a interesting line. And, of course, it led to the fact that Inti feels everything she sees in ways that most of us do not. That's got to be a very rare condition, isn't it?
It's very rare, yeah.
How'd you come up with it? Where did you?
I actually learned about it on an NPR podcast many years ago called Invisibilia. I don't know if you've heard of it, but they explore sort of kind of interesting science things and phenomenons, and they were talking about this incredible condition, and I just was completely fascinated and obsessed with it. I have a different and much milder case of synesthesia, which is just, it just means that my memory is tied to color and texture and shape. I have a little bit of a kind of insight into, I guess, experiencing things slightly differently, which is why I've always been kind of fascinated with different sorts of synesthesia. And this one, mirror touch, is kind of staggeringly interesting and strange, and the way that these people kind of exist in the world is just really amazing. And I guess that kind of ultimate empathy just seemed like the perfect curse and gift at the same time. If we're talking about a story that is ultimately about empathy and lack of empathy and what that turns us into.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is. It's such a perfect device for the story that you're telling. There's also some domestic violence in your book, is there not?
There is, yes.
Yeah. I wonder if you could comment on how that finds its way there.
Sure. So at the time when I was writing this book, coming up with it, I was very, very aware of the domestic violence kind of crisis that's going on at the moment. In Australia, the statistics are terrifying. A woman every week is murdered by her romantic partner. And there's something about that really, it felt terrible and important to write about. And I was a bit scared of writing about it, if I'm honest. It's, you know, it's a dark space to kind of enter. I didn't know how it would land or affect people. But I think I have a rule where I write about the things that I care about. And that happens to be a thing that I care about. And so I had to sort of work out how I could tell that story alongside this story about wolves and wildness and the harm that's being done to animals and our planet. And it sort of, it took me a while to kind of figure out how those two things fit together, but ultimately it became very clear to me when I just fundamentally boiled it down to its kind of core principle. And I think it's about, as I said, it's about having empathy, not having empathy, what we become when we don't cultivate that empathetic view of the world and each other. Yeah.
Well, it fits well in the book. I think you've done a masterful job of inserting it into the book in such ways that helps people work through how men and women react. Duncan McTavish, you're the chief superintendent of the local police station, who you've already identified. I found it interesting that he and Inti were having an exchange, and Inti was surprised at how, I don't know whether the word's progressive or what it is, but how realistic Duncan was about domestic violence and how he felt about it, no differently than a woman would feel about it. And that kind of caught Inti off base, I think, a bit, did it not?
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah. I think your main characters need to be flawed. They need to be, they need to live within their own kind of viewpoints until you can force them to step outside of those. So I suppose the way that we kind of meet Inti is that she's very jaded. She's dealt with violent men in her life, and she's come to this sort of, I guess, judgmental opinion that, you know, maybe all men are the same, or if they're not violent, then they don't get it. They don't understand it. She's right. She's surprised to meet this man who does understand it and, in fact, has gone through something very similar to what she's gone through. And that's, you know, that's how you kind of confront your characters. You have them come up against the opposition to their opinions constantly, and you try and crack them open and you try and transform them and make them learn. And I think that's how you create catharsis for your readers. And I hope that that's, you know, Inti's gone on this journey to kind of understand that, in fact, not all people are out to get her.
Right. I'm Bob Custer here at Reader's Corner. You're listening to Charlotte McConaughey. She's the author of Once There Were Wolves. Well, again, I just can't say it enough. There's so much packed into this novel and the life of Duncan McTavish, aside from being the chief superintendent of the police, has his own demons, and you deal with those so well. But again, we have to let our listeners figure all this out when they buy your book. I want to talk about the wolves, because I did learn a lot about wolves in your novel, and twice now in our brief discussion here, you've mentioned how impressive they are as predators. What was it that most surprised you about what you learned about wolves?
I think I was, well, aside from what I've mentioned already, which was the kind of amazing uniqueness of their personalities, I was also very surprised, I suppose, by how misunderstood they are. They're these creatures of myth and fable and fairy tale, and they're the monsters in the stories that we grow up with. They're frightening, dangerous, aggressive creatures, but actually, I mean, that's how we see them, and that's how we're raised to kind of see them. But the amazing thing about wolves is they're actually the opposite to that. They're very shy, very gentle, family-oriented, loyal creatures who are terrified of humans and will in fact do anything to kind of avoid coming into contact with people. And so I found it kind of fascinating that we see them as monsters when in fact it seems very clear to me that the people of most stories are actually the monsters.
Yeah, that's for sure. So one of the things that I think Inti is passing on to fellow townspeople is she says at one point, wolves recognize personality traits. Dominance has little to do with size or aggression. How does that manifest itself in the life of a wolf? I mean, I guess I would have assumed that the dominance was related directly to size and aggression.
Yes. Well, it's interesting. Wolves are actually matriarchal, not patriarchal. So the leader of a wolf pack is the female breeding wolf. I don't think they even call them alphas anymore because it's such a kind of misunderstood term. In fact, what makes you a leader of a wolf pack is your ability to have babies. And there's all these kind of stories about one wolf in particular that I learnt about that lived in Yellowstone, which was male wolf number, I think, 21. But he had this incredible story of leadership of his own pack, but he did it in a way that was very different to how we would perceive male alpha traits. So he was kind, he was gentle, he was loyal, he allowed other male wolves to be more dominant than him physically, knowing that, you know, he would still remain the leader of the pack. He fought with other male wolves and let them live, you know, so he had this kind of really interesting way of leading his pack and always being loyal to his female mate. So I think it's just kind of this, yet again, it's this really misunderstood thing that we think about wolves as just being kind of aggressive and violent, when in fact the best wolf packs are led by cooperation and loyalty and love for each other.
So when it comes to these sheep ranchers, there's somewhere in the book toward the end where you're discussing the fact that it's been pretty rough because these sheep ranchers aren't about, and I guess they're called farmers in Scotland, around Idaho they're called ranchers, but whatever they are, they're not fond of the reintroduction of wolves for sure. No. And I think toward the end, in thinking through the process Inti used to reintroduce them and work with the community, she realizes that she probably could have done it better. Tell us about that.
Well, this is the kind of difficulty, I suppose, of rewilding projects. It relies on reclaiming land that often belongs to people who are farmers or ranchers and trying to make a living by living off the land. And I think, you know, it's easy when you're looking at kind of conservation and rewilding to paint these farmers and ranchers as the enemy. But it's important to remember, I think, that, you know, a lot of these people are living under immense financial pressure, and the idea for them of a predator being brought in to potentially kind of, well, eat a whole lot of their livestock and their way of living is in a way, it's kind of a betrayal of their governments. So, I mean, my father is a farmer. So I come at this from, I guess, a place of trying to understand both perspectives and viewpoints as evenly as possible, with as much nuance as possible, because I think it's important to kind of approach these things with a sense of, I guess, coming together rather than division and blame. And that's always the sort of point that I try to write from, is that idea of eventually being able to come together. And, you know, that's the transformation that Inti has to go through as well. She starts off as quite a judgmental person who's kind of got, you know, she's got blinkers on. She sees the world from her own point of view, and that's it. But in order to achieve positive outcome on this sort of project, it will rely on cooperation, working together, communicating with each other, or else it's just, you know, it's never going to work.
Yes, and I suppose that's probably what we've learned in Idaho as well. Mm-hmm. So can we expect you to devote future novels to climate fiction? I'm reminded of Nevada Barr, who is an author who was, I believe, at one time in her life, a ranger for the U.S. government in national parks. And she ended up writing a whole series, I think she still does, a whole series of novels about national park experiences. They're mysteries. And your two books here sounds like you're onto something here. This idea of climate fiction, maybe there's another rewilding project out there for you. Where are you going from here?
Maybe, yes. I mean, look, it's funny. It's not that I set out to write climate fiction, but I guess I just try and write about the things that I care about. And at the moment, this is something that I care about. So I guess it will continue to be a topic of my books. I'm working on a third at the moment, which is set down on a sub-Antarctic island with a family of caretakers on this island, and the sea levels rising rapidly and endangering them. And so, yeah, there's obviously definitely a kind of climate theme running through all of it. And that book is about sort of, I guess, how we approach raising children in a dying world. So yeah, I guess if I do kind of bring climate into each of my books, I suppose I will try to grapple with it or explore it from different perspectives and in different ways. Because I just feel like it's such an important thing that's happening in all our lives right now.
Well, you've certainly caught the attention of the reviewers and those who make it their job to pass along recommendations for books. This book has been well received and well reviewed, just as Migrations has. We've run out of time, Charlotte, but I once again want our readers to know that I finished this book and consider it to be one of the best novels I've read this year, and certainly one of the most exciting. And try to predict the ending to this. You will not do it, I guarantee you. So it's Once There Were Wolves by Charlotte McConachy. And don't forget, after you finish that one, or do in reverse, Migrations, a novel by Charlotte McConachy. Charlotte, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to chat.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.